Today, household financial pressures and RBA propaganda. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis, from this post covering finance and property news. Well, on Tuesday in my live stream, I'll be sharing the latest information relating to our household surveys and financial stress. And the headline news is that financial stress, particularly among renters, continues to rise, and it's very high amongst those with a mortgage. But of course, it's all a matter of definition when it comes to financial stress. And in fact, Andrea Brashico, head of financial stability at the RBA, gave a speech at the Sydney Banking and Financial Stability Conference this last week, and it was titled Financial Stability and the Financial Health of Australian Mortgagors. Now, I want to take you through this speech because there are some very important messages, but I also want to highlight how the information is being spun. It is, frankly, propaganda. And I want to draw some threads from this to help frame the real debate, which is, to what extent is financial stability a risk based on what households are feeling and experiencing with regard specifically to their financial commitments? Now, she starts by saying there's understandably been a lot of focus on this whole issue, with many households facing substantial financial pressures from high inflation and higher interest rates, indeed, and also, of course, I'd add high taxes too. Some of the households feeling those pressures, mostly acutely, she said, are those with lower incomes, including many renters. And then she went on to say that the focus of her speech was on households with mortgages and how their financial health relates to financial stability. So she's immediately excluded the one third of households in the rental sector who have the most severe financial problems and who, by the way, are borrowing quite a lot more in terms of unsecured credit to try and get by and are also accessing buy now, pay later. So that's quite a convenient swerve, in my view, looking at the whole of the economy. And then she went on to say, there's been a lot said and written about the issue of household financial stress in recent times, using a multitude of data sources and reporting on many different individual experiences. And she said last Wednesday's national accounts showed how inflation, tax, and interest rates have weighed on real household disposable income. Spot on, they have. Of course, GDP per capita went backwards severely again. And she said, as the RBA Governor Michelle Bullock said when discussing the challenge of inflation following the RBA board meeting this week, high inflation makes life difficult for everyone and damages the functioning of the economy. It erodes the value of savings, hurts household budgets, makes it harder for businesses to plan and invest, and worsens income inequality. And the Governor emphasised that the effect of all of this is that many households are experiencing a painful squeeze on their finances. That is true, and I agree with that statement and what the RBA has said there specifically. So in the speech today, she presented an overall picture of the situation, drawing on the, quote, RBA's extensive work in the area, unquote, which is published, by the way, in detail in the Financial Stability Review. And she concludes that while budget pressures are being felt widely across indebted households, most of those households have managed to adjust to these pressures. And while there has been an increase in the number of borrowers who are under severe financial stress, the vast majority of borrowers remain able to cover basic expenses and service their loans. Now, it's really important to understand that definition. I'll say it again, cover basic expenses and to service their loans. So they are excluding some categories of expenditure from household cash flows when they make this analysis. We'll talk about that more in a moment. Financial stress among indebted households have the potential to have a direct impact on financial stability, she said, with all the adverse consequences that financial instability can have on the broader economy and thus households. Housing loans make up nearly half of Australian banks' exposures. Therefore, if any sufficiently large number of mortgagors were in default on their loans, lenders would face widespread losses as a result. And if those losses were large enough, this could lead to lenders sharply restricting the supply of credit to even very sound borrowers. And this could then disrupt economic activity and result in rising unemployment. Unemployment, in turn, would further increase financial stress among households and businesses, leading to further loan defaults, bank losses, and pullback on the supply of credit. And if households and businesses became concerned that their deposits at banks might not be safe, financial system stability and economic activity would be disrupted further still. This feedback between financial stress of indebted households and financial stability, where disruptions to the functioning of the financial system affect the functioning of the economy, would come at a very high cost to all. And I agree with that analysis. That feedback loop is one that I've been concerned about for many years, because our banks in Australia are so highly leveraged to particularly the housing sector. And by the way, that half is a bit understating the true exposure, because of course you should also include the banks lending to the building and construction sector as well. And not only that, but if you also take account of investment mortgages, then it's even higher. Now, she was at pains to say that financial stress among households does not automatically imply financial instability, though. Indeed, there appears to be, she said, a low risk that financial pressures currently being experienced by Australian borrowers will translate into financial stability issues. And she went through how she came to that assessment. So, once again, she said, the RBA spends a lot of time carefully monitoring the financial health of Australian households so that we understand the overall extent of financial stress and how this is likely to evolve. But there is no single definition of financial stress. I agree that there isn't. But rather, financial stress can best be thought of as an existing across a spectrum. Actually, this is a very good chart, because at the milder end, budget pressures can force households to cut back on discretionary spending, reduce their rate of savings, or draw down on their stock of savings. While unwelcome, most borrowers, therefore, usually have several means to adjust to budget pressures to avoid or at least delay entering financial stress. And by the way, I measure financial stress, mortgage stress and rental stress, at that opening aperture end of the analysis. In other words, at the point where they are having to make hard decisions about what they spend their cash on. And she said, moving along the spectrum as budget pressures rise or household saving buffers deplete, households worried about being able to pay their bills may find themselves having to cut back expenditure even further and or resort to finding more work. And at the extreme end, households in severe financial stress are then unable to service their debts or pay their essential bills out of their income and savings. And first and foremost, this has a significant negative impact on their lives and well-being. But she says, as I described earlier, this tail end of financial stress can also have implications for financial stability. Now, one of the things that she doesn't really mention is that households, as they traverse this spectrum and become more stressed, tend to grab more credit, particularly unsecured credit, credit card, for example, buy now, pay later, and even payday loans. And this financial stress feedback loop is something that should have been incorporated in their commentary, in my view. And she said that households' experience with this spectrum can be very different. There are usually many more households at the milder end than at the extreme end of the spectrum. And this is also the case today. I agree with that. A lot of households are still mildly stressed, but are stressed nevertheless. Of the households that do enter severe financial stress, most do so suddenly as a result of a disruptive event such as illness or job loss. Don't agree with that. She should also take account of the fact that time is also a crunch factor. The longer that households have negative cash flow, the more likely they are to drift further over to the right. Time is something that needs to be considered, particularly bearing in mind that, for example, in the US, after the global financial crisis, the peak of defaults happened 3 years later. It takes time to season. She went on to say, however, in other cases, financial stress arises more gradually as some households exhaust their options to adjust to a build-up phase of budget pressures, they move through different phases of the spectrum towards the extreme end. Most households do not move through the entire spectrum, though. Many are able to take action to avert becoming insolvent. This may be through finding extra work or reducing their discretionary spending. And indebted households may also resolve the situation by seeking temporary hardship assistance from their lender, and often as a last resort and at high personal costs, by reducing or repaying their debt through selling assets, including their family home. These difficult decisions first and foremost help households adjust to financial pressure, but in doing so, they also help support stability of the financial system and the economy. And one of the things she should have said is that banks are much, much more accommodative now relating to dealing with this pressure, particularly on mortgage repayments. So there's a lot more a willingness of banks to restructure and extend loan repayments further or move to interest only. If you go back 20 years or so, that was hardly a thing. Now, she said, to assess how financial stress is building along the spectrum, the RBA closely monitors a broad range of indicators. This recognises that no single metric can capture the full picture, as well as that data quality varies substantially both across different household groups and along the spectrum of financial stress. Loan arrears and insolvencies allow us to monitor late stages of severe financial stress for indebted households with relative precision and in a timely manner. This includes households owning and operating small businesses. But of course, this default measure is a rear view mirror. It's telling you what has happened, not what may happen. In contrast, she said, there is no universally accepted measure of budget pressures, with many available surveys measuring a range of different concepts. One set of data we use is loan level data from the RBA securitization system to provide a good guide to the financial position of individual households with mortgages. Those data points cover one third of all Australian mortgages. That's almost 2 million loans. And using this data set allows us to estimate the financial positions of indebted households and assess how their financial positions could evolve under different scenarios. Now, I have a problem with this. Securitized loans are cherry-picked. They are not necessarily representative of all mortgages in Australia. So by definition, the RBA is selecting a series of mortgages that may not be representative of the whole. I would argue quite clearly this is not the case. So with that caveat, she says, what does this information tell us about the current financial health of Australian households and for those with mortgages in particular? She said, one message it tells us is that budget pressures are being felt very broadly across households. Big tick there. I see that in my surveys. We know many have curtailed their consumption and made other adjustments in response. Agreed with that too. But incidences of severe financial stress, where people are struggling to meet even their most basic expenses, is currently limited to a much smaller group. Starting with the aggregate picture, we know that high inflation and high interest rates have reduced households' spare income. She should have mentioned here the tax take, which of course is much higher than it's been pretty much forever. A range of surveys and indicators are consistent with widespread financial pressures and suggest that financial stress is building in its early stages. Households' assessment of their family finances fell sharply in early 2022 with the rise in inflation and interest rates and has remained near record lows since. And you can see from the graph, the fall has been greatest for those with mortgages on their home. In fact, Google searches of terms related to household financial stress have also trended up. And financial counselling services such as the National Debt Helpline and other community organisations have increased demand for their services over the same period. While financial pressures have increased, to date, she said, most households have managed to adjust to these pressures. They have done so in a number of ways. Some households have managed to increase their hours of work or switch to a higher paid job, supported by the strong labour market. So even though most workers have seen a decline in their base wages in real terms, their overall employment income are generally held up better. Of course, that's pre-tax rather than post-tax. So again, not telling the true story. Many households have also had to make adjustments to their consumption. And as a result, consumption growth has been subdued, particularly on a per capita basis. Finally, households have also adjusted their savings. After saving much more than usual during the pandemic, households are now saving less than they did on average in the years before. Indeed, as the Financial Stability Review showed, the share of borrowers who are persistently drawing out of their stock of savings has increased from previous years. So these adjustments have meant that to date, the substantial pressure on households' budgets has not translated into a sharp increase in late-stage financial stress. Both loan arrears and personal insolvencies, business-related and other, have increased from their low levels during the pandemic, but most households continue to be able to service their debts. Indeed, close to 99% of loans remain on or ahead of schedule. However, she said, we know that budget pressures and incidences of financial stress vary widely across households. This is especially true at the current juncture, where the need for monetary policy to respond to high inflation has caused a sharp increase in interest rates, which has substantially increased mortgage costs. The majority of mortgagors, except those still on low fixed rates, have seen their minimum scheduled payments increase between 30 and 50% since the first increase in the cash rate in May 2022. These borrowers are more likely to have experienced a sharp increase in budget pressures than the overall population. Even within the group of mortgagors, there are some who are experiencing budget pressures more acutely. So to understand the extent of budget pressures across mortgagors, they have used the loan level data from the RBA securitization system. This data provided very timely information about household mortgages, what they currently owe, their required payments, and how much they have saved in their offset and redraw accounts, as well as their reported income at the point the loan was originated. Now, hang on. Say that again. Income as reported at the point of origination. So that is not contemporary data, that's historic data. And then they have conservatively assumed that borrowers' incomes have grown in line with the wage price index over time. This data gives the most complete picture for variable rate owner-occupier borrowers because the borrowers, compared with the fixed rate or investor borrowers, are most likely to hold their savings in their mortgage accounts. And accordingly, the analysis relates specifically to variable rate owner-occupier borrowers who make up around half of all mortgagors and one-fifth of all households. So hang on a moment. We've now stripped out all those on a fixed rate mortgage and we're only looking at variable rate mortgages. So again, this is a partial picture. Estimates from the securitized data shows that many borrowers are now devoting a considerably larger share of their income to servicing their debts than early 2022, when interest rates were at their lowest. Just over 20% of variable rate owner-occupied borrowers are now estimated to devote more than 30% of their income to mortgage payments. And as the graph shows, households with lower incomes are more likely than other borrowers to devote a larger share of their income to servicing their mortgage. In addition, essential expenses also make up a larger share of income for those borrowers. By comparisons, households with higher income devote a smaller share of their income to essential expenses, so they are typically able to service larger mortgage payments relative to their incomes without encountering financial stress. So while this metric is often reported as a measure of mortgage stress, it's important to note that it does not provide a complete picture, she says. Well, I think that she's right on that, but for the wrong reasons. To better understand the financial pressures a household is facing, we can estimate borrowers' cash flows using the securitization data, along with the Melbourne Institute's household expenditure measure that provides an estimate of essential expenses given their income and family composition. Based on this data, we estimate that around 95% of variable rate owner-occupied borrowers still have spare income after meeting their mortgage payments and essential expenses. Again, this is essential expenses. Remember that the HEM only excludes a relatively narrow set of expenses. So, she said, while just over 20% of borrowers are estimated to spend more than 30% of their income on mortgage payments, a much lower share, around 5%, is estimated to find their income insufficient to cover their mortgage payments and essential expenses. And she says, as you can see from the graph, low-income households are more likely to have an income shortfall than borrowers on higher incomes. But she said, we know from the securitization data that most of the 5% of variable rate owner-occupied borrowers who we estimate have an income shortfall do have substantial savings buffers. That is, they have sufficient savings in their mortgage offset and redraw accounts to finance their income shortfalls for some time. This gives them time to explore their options. Then that leaves less than 2% of all variable rate owner-occupied borrowers, as shown in the two left-hand columns of the graph, who have both an income shortfall and low savings buffers, and so could fall into severe financial stress within 6 months, assuming interest rates remain around current levels. Lower income borrowers are again overrepresented in this group, as shown by the yellow portion of the bar, as are borrowers with higher leverage. These results have all pertained to variable rate owner-occupier borrowers. While we don't have a complete data set for fixed rate borrowers, we can use a range of surveys to build a fairly good picture. And this picture is one of similar resilience. Borrowers rolling off fixed rate loans are likely to see similarly sized increases in their mortgage costs as those experienced by variable rate borrowers. But fixed rate borrowers have also avoided higher loan payments for longer. And this has allowed them to build up substantial savings on par with those of comparable variable rate borrowers. Consistent with this, loan arrears are lower for current fixed rate borrowers when compared to those on variable rate owner-occupier borrowers, and borrowers who have recently rolled off fixed rates have similar arrears to other variable rate borrowers. And so she concludes that while budget pressures are widespread, most borrowers appear well placed to service their debt and cover essential costs. Indeed, they estimate that less than 2% of variable rate owner-occupier borrowers are currently at real risk of not being able to cover their basic expenses and mortgage payments out of their current income and don't have significant savings buffers to fall back on. In scenarios where the unemployment rate rise or interest rates increase further, the share of households in severe financial stress would indeed rise. However, given the solid financial position of the bulk of borrowers, most are also expected to be resilient in those circumstances. So, she said, the data shows us that even in the event of job losses, where a household loses all their income, around half of all variable rate owner-occupier borrowers would still have sufficient buffers in their offset or redraw accounts to sustain their scheduled mortgage payments and essential expenditures for at least 6 months. Now, the problem here is that this is an average across households. And of course, we know that not everybody has those buffers in offset accounts. And generally, those with lower income levels and more stress have less offset account balances available. But she said, this scenario is quite unlikely for many mortgagors. More than half of households with mortgages have multiple incomes, making it less likely they will lose their entire household income. So let's just pause there. She's saying, if there's a two-income household and one income stops, the other income will be sufficient to cover the mortgage payment. Well, that might be true, but what about other household expenses? That is a nonsense argument. Bearing in mind that the typical borrower today has an income ratio of somewhere between 5 and 6 times, whereas if you go back 20 years, it was 2 or 3 times. So she said, the broader financial stability risk from the household sector appears contained. Even if the unemployment rate were to increase by 2 percentage points, that's around 3 to 4 times as sharply as projected in the November 23 statement on monetary policy, the share of borrowers at risk running out of savings buffers over the next year or so would remain low at single-digit levels. And finally, she said, there's another important layer supporting households and financial stability. It's the fact that most households have substantial equity in their homes, reflecting prudent lending standards under APRA's regulatory framework and the general increase in housing prices over the number of years. Less than 1% of loans are estimated to currently be in negative equity. In the event of a household becoming unable to continue servicing their loan, this gives them the option of selling their home and repaying their loan. While very disruptive and with real-life costs for affected households, this protects both them and their lenders against default. There could still be risks to the real economy from high household debt and rising financial pressures on Australian borrowers. But even in a downside economic scenario, she said, high starting levels of borrower resilience together with high starting levels of equity in housing loans means that losses incurred by lenders are likely to remain manageable. And also, APRA's strong prudential framework and supervision means that banks hold high levels of capital and liquidity. This means banks are well placed to withstand such losses while continuing to lend to households and businesses, thus supporting economic activity even in very challenging economic conditions. Now, there's three points to make here. I absolutely agree with the RBA that there is a continuum between the pressure on households, money in being less than money out, across to default. That journey can take several years to progress, and it's also true that a number of households have significant financial buffers, including in offsets accounts and savings. But the second point is this. This picture will change, firstly, if unemployment starts to rise, but secondly, if interest rates stay in and around their current levels over the medium term. I remind you again, in the US, it took 3 years for the worst of the interest rate rises to bite in terms of defaults. I think we could see the same here. The third is that the very basis of the calculations that the RBA has done on basic expenses excludes things like school fees and medical expenses and other bits and pieces like that. So it's a very basic level of existence. Now, in my surveys, I look at all outgoings of all categories. And this then gives me a very early indication of the level of pressure on households. And as I'll show you next Tuesday, when we look at individual postcodes, we can see that disposable income, which of course in real term continues to get compressed because of the high tax take and because wage increases are lower than inflation, which means that the cost of living continue to drain from households' cash flow, that many households are ending up with significantly higher proportion than 30% of their income supporting their mortgage or rental payments. So the bottom line is this, how sustainable is what we have here? Well, the RBA, using its data sources and arguing quite carefully around some of the critical issues, is able to say nothing to see here. Financial stability is not a problem. And I tend to agree with regard to financial stability because of the equity that's in many households and the fact that, of course, the banks are very willing at the moment to extend and pretend for a lot longer. But you can't get away from the fundamental issue that many households are struggling with cash flow pressures. They're cutting back on their spending, and those spending choices that they're making or not making will in turn lead to significant pressure on the broader economy. That broader economy in turn, as it eases back, could well put more pressure on the banks and give them less capacity to lend, and also put more pressure on unemployment, which could also in turn lead to households then having incomes under even more severe compression. And the point I want to leave you with is this. In my modelling, I take account of the steady state position in terms of cash flow, money in, money out, and I simply ask how many households are ending up with a deficit. They can plug that deficit by raiding savings or indeed pulling down credit on a credit card or other type of loan or indeed refinance and extend and pretend a bit further. But over time, if households continue to drain their resources such that they are in negative flow, they will continue to cut back on their spending and they will actually ultimately have to make more tough decisions down the line. So it does come back, to my mind, to what is going to be the forward trajectory in terms of interest rates and to what extent the tax bands will be adjusted to give more leeway to households. If interest rates stay high and the tax take continues to be at an inflated level because the bands are not moved, then more households are going to get in difficulty, and this stress can lead ultimately to default. But it'll be 2 or 3 years down the track before we see the results. And therefore, my conclusion is that what the RBA has done here is a nice propaganda job, but they're missing some really critical elements, which suggest to me that the real truth around financial stress and households is much more adverse than the RBA is willing to concede at the moment. And of course, the RBA has used some data from its securitization data pools to give some positive spin to the story. And just to remind you that my live stream, which will go out at 8 p.m. Sydney time next Tuesday, will go into significant detail around financial stress, mortgage stress, and rental stress, and we can do a postcode deep dive. I look forward to seeing you then. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching. And I'll see you again next time.